88.5 KRFY. Support for this hour of programming comes to you from Lori Goetz and Clem Yonker. You're listening to the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack Peterson, and I'm joined, as always, by Hannah Combs, Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather Upton, Director Emeritus of that museum. Good morning to the two of you. Hello.
Good morning.
We haven't said that in sync.
Okay. How about good morning, Heather?
Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning.
There. Now people can hopefully recognize you by your voices. We are going to jump right into it this morning. We are skipping the formalities. We have a jam-packed show for you, and there's just no time for anything else. Let's go for it. Our topic this month is the Jesuit missionaries. And in particular, one character comes to the forefront, Pierre-Jean de Smet. And the question, I guess, is who were the Jesuit missionaries who came to this area? When did they come? And why were they here to begin with? I turn now to, I think it's Heather.
Yeah.
You kick things off.
Amazing questions.
Uh-huh.
So Father John de Smet was born in 1801 in Belgium amidst the upheaval of the Napoleonic Wars. So not long before in 1791, all priests who refused to swear fidelity to the French Revolutionary Constitution were forced out of Belgium. So many were imprisoned and condemned to forced labor. One individual particularly was de Smet's older brother, Jean-Baptiste. He was a diocesan priest. It's a lot of big words on a Monday morning. So he was exiled to the island of Rhé and had been ransomed by his father. So a lot of tumultuous things happening in the Smet family. And as a child, Peter John de Smet, later known as Pierre John de Smet, grew up in the strict Catholic household. It was wealthy. His parents were very important socially in Belgium. He was very indifferent in school, though, and he preferred to spend most of his time outside, roughing around on the docks. His father owned a merchant company and shipped, you know, important goods. His father said of him, "May God protect him. He will either be a soldier or a great traveler, but he will never be able to lead a quiet life."
So, concerned by his son's daredevil antics, Josse de Smet sent his son to a Catholic boarding school in Ghent, hoping they would stifle his wayward tendencies. Instead, several years later, when he was 20, they made him an offer he couldn't refuse, to join the Catholic Missionary Corps in America. De Smet's father caught wind of the scheme and sent Peter John's older brother to stop him. His father wanted the young man to join him in his merchant business. But when the two brothers reunited, young Peter John spoke so passionately about his purpose as a missionary that not only did his brother not stop him, but he funded his journey to America. It was the first of many instances when his passionate rhetoric benefited the church monetarily as well as evangelically. So when he gets to America, after 3 years of training in Maryland, during which de Smet committed himself to the religious faith, not only to the perceived adventure of the missionary life, he was selected as one of the novices sent to retrace Lewis and Clark's route down the Ohio River to the St. Louis Mission on the Missouri frontier. Once there, he finished his training, received holy orders, and donned the black robes of the order.
So this is about the mid-1820s, early 1820s.
Yeah, this is right around, by the time he's there, this is right around 1820, close to 1830, actually, okay. At this point.
And when he committed to this life, what was he signing up for? And like, how did the Jesuits measure success, and who did they report to?
Well, the measure of success for the Jesuit missionaries were to obliterate paganism and replace it with the attributes of Christianity and Western civilization. So over the course of his career, De Smet seemed to have taken on a broader view of his duties. He was also a culture broker, serving as a go-between for religious, governmental, and military installations interested in communicating with Indians.
Ecclesiastical protocol is what governed the Jesuits at every level. They were expected to regularly report to their superiors, as well as send updates to other missionaries whose work or travel plans might be aided by their knowledge. This was generally done through letter writing. And just kind of a fun aside, Ignatius Loyola, who founded the Jesuit order, wrote over 7,000 letters during his lifetime, which is considered the most correspondence of any figure in the 16th century.
That's a good tally. 7,000. Okay, so they signed up to convert what they were calling pagans on the border of the wilderness. What does that mean? Who are they preaching to?
Well, both the Native Americans and European settlers. And I just want to remark on the word, like the saying black robes. I think that's so interesting. And I was reading about there was a definition of why they called them that. And so they carried the cross and they never married women. So that was it.
Yeah.
It was that simple.
And they literally wore black robes.
Which was so true. I just see them like marching down the frontier.
Yeah.
Which is so true, right?
And that's what he was wearing. That was his outfit like day to day.
Day to day was a black robe. Uh-huh. Yeah. So they set up school for Osage Indian boys, which introduced the novices to Native American language and customs. But eventually the bishop closed the school. He feared the white settlers, feeling neglected by the Jesuits, would turn to Protestant missionaries, which took money away from the church. So Matt was displeased by the decision and decided if the Indians couldn't come to them, perhaps it was time for them to travel to the tribes. Money troubles continued to plague the mission and squash De Smet's dreams. So eventually, reminded of De Smet's wealthy parents, his superiors sent him back to Europe, where he spent 4 years raising the equivalent of $1 million from his parents' peers and recruiting more novices. So it's like, sure, Dad, I'll come to you to the party. He's just like cornering people, telling them about his exciting journeys. When he returned, the population of St. Louis had doubled, and the St. Louis bishop had received permission from the Pope to lead the conversion efforts of the Native Americans throughout the American West. However, after Andrew Jackson's Indian Removal Edict in 1830, this meant not only would they be serving the tribes that already lived west of the Mississippi, but the eastern tribes that were unwillingly relocated there. They would have to allocate resources thoughtfully.
So De Smet's back in St. Louis, but eventually he gets here. He comes this far west. He's not in doesn't stay in St. Louis, Missouri. How did that happen?
Yeah, this is another one of those. Well, we kind of did this in the last episode, too, where we have to zoom way out to this national scale to be able to get to the part of the story that happens here. So shortly before Lewis and Clark visited the Bitterroot Salish Territory, which is now in western Montana, in 1806, a Salish prophet named Shining Shirt had a vision foretelling of black-robed men bearing crosses coming to their land to teach them a new set of morals and a new way to pray. Following the War of 1812, several Iroquois men, including Ignace Lamuse served as canoe guides for the Northwest Company's explorations into the Northwest and took up residence with the Flathead. When Ignace mentioned the Black Robes who had baptized him in eastern Canada, the Flathead remembered Shining Shirt's prophecy. According to Dr. Robert Carricker, De Smet's biographer, the ritual splendor of Christianity gripped the imagination of the Flatheads, and they were curious to learn more. The Christian God also offered hope to a tribe that had been rocked by dangers introduced by the white men. Fur traders carried diseases that could decimate tribal populations, and horses and guns introduced by Europeans gave the Blackfeet tribe the ability to cut them off from long-shared hunting grounds. The Iroquois, full of fervor for their adopted god, made big promises on this god's behalf, telling the Flatheads that the Christian god could stop the spread of disease or even bullets in their tracks.
Interesting. So Ignace Lamuse made two trips to St. Louis to ask the bishop to send a missionary to his adopted tribe in the Rocky Mountains. The Jesuits, ever cautious of their resources, likely would have postponed a mission so far into the wilderness, had not the Protestants kicked off a missionary race to the west. However, the Protestants never quite made it to the Flatheads, seeming to veer into more hospitable claims like the Willamette Valley. Their efforts did spur the Jesuits to act, and De Smet was asked to lead the first outpost in Council Bluffs along the Missouri River.
Okay, before I ask my next question, this Shining Shirt prophecy, is that real, or is that a kind of a myth? Is that folklore? Was there really somebody who said this at, you know, before in the days before Lewis and Clark, that somebody had predicted that, you know?
According to the tribe's oral tradition, this is what happened. Yeah. Huh. Isn't that remarkable?
It is.
It really is spooky. Incredible.
It makes you shiver a little bit. Okay. So they were in, where were they? Council Bluffs? That was the that was the next stop.
Modern day Iowa.
Okay. Which is not terribly far. That's still still pretty far from here.
Correct.
Okay. So how long did it take him to get further west, come out this way? Or you know, closer, and also like how are the tribes receiving him as he goes along?
Yeah, so that varied tribe by tribe. In Council Bluffs, De Smet did not make very much progress. He was demoralized by the Potawatomi's addiction to alcohol, which had been introduced by riverboat captains, and its repercussions, which could be pretty violent. But in 1839, he happened to run into Ignace Lamuse again. Immediately connecting over their shared French language, De Smet learned Ignace was still intent on procuring a missionary for the Flathead. De Smet longed to work with the remote northern tribe, which he imagined was uncorrupted by whiskey. So, anxious to secure the post before it was assigned to someone else, he fabricated a reason to head back to St. Louis in the dead of winter. Despite the onset of a serious bronchial infection, he advocated so fervently with his superiors that they had, as they said, no choice but to assign him to the Flathead. He traveled for weeks with a fur trapper contingent to the annual rendezvous in Wyoming, then up to Pierre's Hole in the modern-day Teton Valley in modern-day Idaho. There he spoke to a crowd of 1,600 Flathead, Ponderay, and Nez Perce Indians, some of whom had traveled over 800 miles to hear him speak. They were an eager audience, and he baptized over 200 people over 4 days.
Wow.
It's a huge crowd. Yeah. 1,600 people.
Yeah.
And his reputation was preceding him.
Yeah, which is interesting because he hadn't done that much yet at this point. But he was such a good speaker and so passionate about his work.
And back to what you were asking about with the visions of Shining Shirt.
Yeah.
He
was the Black Robe.
Yeah. So did he stay with now that he made it as far as the Teton Valley? Did he stay there? Or where did he go next?
Yeah, promising to return the following spring, De Smet returned to St. Louis, networking with 15 other tribes along the way. Noting how pleased he was that the Flathead were not yet corrupted by civilization, so they hadn't been introduced to alcohol and other vices. So when his superiors told him his new mission would not receive any funding, he traveled from Philadelphia to New Orleans, raising grassroots support and funds for his project.
I feel like he must have the fastest horse in the country. Like, how does he travel so much
He's zigzagging back and forth. I thought, I mean, what little I knew was kind of that he made it out here. I thought it would be one progression out here.
Godspeed, literally.
Comes out back to St. Louis, down to New Orleans. Yeah.
I guess he is taking advantage of the how fast river travel can be.
Oh, yeah.
When he can, which does speed things up quite a bit.
When he's back in civilization, right? I guess he can take a riverboat. Cool. You were saying, though.
Yeah, yes. Definitely. Mm-hmm. The following summer, with two other missionaries, just met up with the Flathead south of Butte and traveled to the Bitterroot Valley, where he anointed the campsite as St. Mary's Mission. Over the winter, the Flathead had diligently followed the rituals he shared with them and were eager to learn more. De Smet was optimistic about the Flathead's proximity to other tribes, envisioning the potential to convert up to 200,000 across a carefully planned network of missions, with St. Mary's as the hub. So I'm trying to think of, so his work is pretty incredible in terms of his mission. Mm-hmm. He's accomplishing his goals. It reminds me of like a modern day, who was that with like Tammy Faye?
Oh, yeah, he's a televangelist. What's his name? Yeah.
That's speaking to huge crowds.
Yeah. And just like
inspiring immediate action or conversion.
Mm-hmm. So intoxicating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So European missionaries had a variety of backgrounds and skills suited for wilderness work. Even though he was the most charismatic, his team contributed a lot to this work as well. De Smet's crew included men skilled in linguistics who could translate Catholic prayers and commandments into the native tongues. He also had people skilled in music, in doctoring, in architecture, education, blacksmithing, carpentry, even tinsmithing. So, feeling secure leaving the construction of the St. Mary's Mission to his fellow priests, De Smet set out on what he called a shopping trip to Fort Colville in northern Washington to secure seed crops and tools. The journey along the Clark Fork River, so what we now drive as Highway 200, though probably a slightly different route, he wrote in his journals, surpassed all others in horrors, but his trusty mule never faltered, even on many cliff edges.
Wow.
Okay. And he went along the Clark Fork River, but not by river. He was on
Correct.
His horse.
They were on mules.
Okay. Yeah.
Which sounds treacherous.
It does. It doesn't necessarily sound like the best way to get down the Clark Fork River.
Right.
Me.
But if you think like pre-dams, these rivers were wildly different than they are today.
Yeah. There's a few places.
Yeah. He has an account. We didn't really talk about it, but he heads over to Fort Vancouver on the Columbia River. And when they get to the Dalles, he sees himself as being a scaredy cat, but he gets out of the boat and he's like, I'll walk around while you guys go through these rapids. And they're like, oh, yeah, okay. And then he's standing on the shore watching as this boat is absolutely just crushed in the rapids and all the men and all the gear is just like flung out all over the river. And so he had good reason to be a little cautious.
Good intuition.
Okay. He wasn't, didn't enjoy his time in a boat, I guess.
Oh my gosh, I can imagine.
Yeah. That is interesting. So I don't know if you were planning to get into this, but there's a fort in Colville. That he can go to.
Yes.
But otherwise, in this area, I mean, this is well before the railroads. So this
Correct.
is
It's the only way to get like goods that he would know how to use in terms of setting up an agriculturally based community.
And as far as like the European population, we've talked about this in previous episodes, but it's pretty scant
just
compared
some
to
scruffy fur trappers here and there.
And it's mostly he's talking to Native Americans. Okay. But once again, I've interrupted to kind of get a picture of, I guess,
there were expectations of that happening. And that's why we didn't read our what's happening in the newspaper clip, because this is so fascinating. And I think it touches all of us in such a deep way, too.
So the
interesting.
Yeah. The journey along the Clark Fork River is the most treacherous, because I guess this presumably there's like no road.
It's because of ice age floods, like just tying back to
the right. Right, because of the ice age floods.
So on the way, he met with three different camps of Kalispell Indians. As Dr. Carriker wrote, the Kalispells respected the oral tradition, and De Smet knew how to tell a good story. He impressed their warriors first with anecdotes from the Napoleonic Wars, transitioned into some of the more dynamic and impressive Bible stories, and left them with translations of the Lord's Prayer and the Ten Commandments, assigning each line to a different person and teaching them to say them in order until they were memorized. Wow.
Mm.
The first person to memorize the prayers received a medal. Both the Jesuits and Indians believed in sacred objects to heal and protect. The Salish place so much importance on the medal of St. Mary. It is said that when they even lost one of their medals, a grown man would cry in sorrow, which is really incredible. So he was just a winner knowing how to connect to people and educate them. And
So we had the vision of Shining Shirt that the black robes would come, but this, it seems like there's a more lasting attraction to this religion for the Northwest tribes. How would they have perceived the Catholic faith, as far as in comparison or through the lens of the tribal spiritual beliefs and traditions that they were used to before?
Yeah, there were many parallels between the Catholic and Native faiths, which helped facilitate a dialogue between the two cultures. Both spiritual faiths valued generosity, community, obedience, and respect for family. The natives recognized and responded to the sacramental and transformative power of chant, prayer, and following a devotional calendar. The sacred nature of certain colors, seasons, sights, and objects were all familiar to them, and visions and miracles were present in both spiritual cultures. They both used water and smoke for purification and for transporting prayers to the spirit worlds. Rituals were sensory and dramatic, and the intercessory power of saintly guardians was very attractive to them.
A lot of parallels.
It's fascinating to think about those.
When you bring it up, it's like, oh yeah. There's a rhyme here.
So within the rules of their order, the Jesuits were free to adapt themselves to the lifestyles and languages of the natives they met. This willingness to accept the hospitality and customs of the tribes helped them gain their trust and communicated to the Native Americans that they were committed to their salvation. The Jesuits' affinity for Native cultures around the world shocked European society, but it also made them the most successful missionaries in the world. So slowly the tribes began incorporating European traditions into their daily lives. European patterns started to be woven into regalia. As buffalo hides became scarce, tribal women turned to canvas and mattress ticking for lodge covers. Native children played the same games pioneer children did. In battle, warriors relied on their war medicine, but also the power of Jesus and Mary to protect them against enemies. So there's this incredible historic photo in one of the books that we were referencing, Sacred Encounters, incredible book. And it shows these teepees with mattress ticking and these incredible patterns from the canvas from more modern day European styles. Mm-hmm. And it is so traditional with a twist. Yeah. It's incredible to see. Mm-hmm. And so unique. And it does make sense. But what an amazing pivot moment there.
Yeah.
Hmm. What about, I don't know, what didn't go down so smoothly? Were any friction there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there were a few ideas which the tribe struggled with. And one of the most important ones was sin and hell. Those were strange concepts to them. They also resisted the Catholic authoritarianism. Excuse me, I botched that. And they could only accept the imposition of European social, political, and economic values to some point. And many missionaries did criticize or try to discredit some of the native rituals. They called respected medicine men evil and frowned upon mind-altering substances used in important spiritual rituals.
That is, what are we listening to? Oh, is it you? Is it Heather?
Oh.
This is live. We're here. You're listening live to the radio. Community character
I literally hour. Have my phone on silent. Uh-huh. And all of a sudden, Always Remember This Way comes on by Lady Gaga. I have no idea how that happened.
That's bizarre. You know what? It's this subject we're talking about. I think this is... Somebody didn't like what you said.
That was like a big woo-woo moment because I literally did not touch my phone. No. I can't even imagine how that happened. That?
We were all watching it. It just started happening. I thought it was coming over the radio or over the headphones. I was trying to figure out where that was coming from. Okay.
So I was just talking about evil.
Friction points.
And how some of the Jesuits were trying to discredit their spiritual practices.
Let me reframe us here. You're listening to the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack Peterson. I'm here. That's Heather, you were just hearing. We're here with Hannah Combs as well. Heather Upton and Hannah Combs, both of them have been or are directors of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum. And we're talking right now about the Jesuit missionaries who came to this area well before the railroads and kind of the impact that they had on local culture and the remaining impact that they have today, although we haven't gotten to that part of the story yet. And now I turn to you, Hannah. Where were you? Where were we?
Yeah, we were talking about how some of the missionaries were kind of discrediting certain native customs, beliefs. De Smet was pretty sensitive to that. He was so charismatic and so good at understanding how to kind of get people behind his ideas that he probably was pretty cautious about ruffling feathers. But at this point in time, the Flathead are like his dream project in a sense. As I was reading about him, you definitely see this attitude where if he's working with a tribe that isn't as receptive to his teaching, he's kind of like, oh, like this is hard. I don't like this. I want a new project. With the Flathead, it's everything he dreamed of. They are very receptive to his teachings. They are not, you know, there's no like alcohol or anything else that can, you know, in his words, corrupt the corrupting influence of civilization to get in the way of his work. And so he's just feeling really good about the work that he's doing with the Flathead. He's very heady with success at this point. And in that, you know, kind of pride of what he's doing, he overlooked one very important facet of his proselytizing. 10 years earlier, the Iroquois had made a promise that De Smet did not realize he was responsible for upholding, that the Jesuits would save the Flatheads from their enemies, namely the Blackfeet. If the Black Robe wished them to learn prayers, sing hymns, and partake in Christian rituals, it was a small price to pay for invincibility, was kind of how they saw it, or at least how some of them still saw this.
Well, this is very interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he's preaching to the Flathead, and they're being incredibly receptive, and unbeknownst to Desmet, part of that, you know, that good reception is that they think he's this, that the Jesuits are, that they have magic powers or whatever is going to.
So on the one hand, there are the Catholic faith complements the beliefs that they already had. Mm-hmm. And there are all of these attractive facets of it with the rituals, with the, you know, traditions. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they literally think that the Black Robes will save them from the Blackfeet, and that the Blackfeet will not be able to stop them from accessing Buffalo anymore, that the Blackfeet, the Blackfeet's guns will not be able to hurt them. So this is a big promise that Desmet isn't really aware he's supposed to uphold.
Yeah.
But preaching about... the word.
And,
I could imagine that if, you know.
And if you think of the language
he's
probably using, saying like, God is your salvation.
Yes.
God will save you. But like you mentioned, this idea of hell was very foreign to them. I'm not positive, but I think the concept of the afterlife was different.
I do believe that's. And pivots.
And so when Desmet's saying things like God will save you, God is your salvation, it might have been perceived as some like God will save you in your current life.
Absolutely.
Not the way Desmet meant it as like you will be saved in the afterlife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to at this time, I know we mentioned it earlier, but the Blackfeet are well armed.
Yeah.
And they're the dominant, the powerful tribe in the area.
Yeah. They kind of pretty much all of the tribes west of them had to kind of submit to them if it came to a confrontation.
Yeah.
To the east, they had more, you know, powerful tribes that they clashed with occasionally. Mm-hmm. But so at this point, Desmet was a bit more focused on his own objectives than on really listening to what the tribes were telling him they needed. He was masterminding self-sufficient missionary sites throughout the Oregon Territory. So he had a big vision for his work.
Mm-hmm.
He intended to set up agricultural, set these missions up based on agriculture with farm, because farm work modeled an American work ethic that he was encouraging the natives to emulate. Desmet alternated between exploring new territories, which led to an incredible documentation of the region, people, and cultural traditions. But he was also networking with other tribes and other missionaries, and he was still going back and forth to St. Louis or Europe to petition for more funding as well.
Still making trips.
Yeah.
Even across back across the...
I am trying to remember. Oh, I read this. It was either 9 or 16 trips he made back and forth to Europe over the course of his life.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Well, a busy guy, let's say. We know he visited with the Kalispel at least once.
Mm-hmm.
Did he ever manage to spend substantial time up closer to where we are, where we broadcast from now, Sandpoint, Idaho, that kind of area?
Well, Desmet was constantly on the move, but occasionally the weather got in the way of his plans, so he was forced to winter over in 1844 at the original Kalispel Mission, so that's near Albany Falls.
Mm-hmm.
Though inconvenienced, he was pleased with the abundant landscape, and the Christmas formed one of the most memorable experiences as a missionary. So we made that indelible mark. So
yeah. Albany.
We as in the Kalispel tribe.
Okay.
The Royal.
Yeah. Albany Falls, though. That's not that's not far.
Just down the river.
Just down the river.
Yeah. Okay. So the St. Michael's Mission Chapel was completed just in time for a spectacular midnight mass celebration. A choir of 300 voices opened the service by singing Christian hymns in their native language. Hmm. That would have been incredible to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned this was at the original Kalispell Mission near Albany Falls.
Yeah.
Does anything remain of that at all?
I have no idea. We need to figure this out. Yeah. So the original St. Michael's Mission was set up near Albany Falls, but I don't know which side of the river that would have been. This was before the dam, so there was an actual waterfall there. Mm-hmm. And there would have been a ferry, but I believe it was built about 20 years later. So at this point in time, it would have been kind of tricky to cross the river around there, but maybe not. I mean, Albany wasn't like the biggest waterfall in the area.
Yeah. Well, that'd be cool. We should check it out.
Yeah.
And that's what's so fun about this episode. I've immersed myself over the years in this region's history, but I've never really spent a ton of time on this specific topic of the missionaries. And and as we dove in and we did research, it was incredible how they were such great archivists, and they documented so much of the local tribes. And it's just a window that you don't really get to see very often.
Yeah, both through written record, like De Smet's journals, and sketches that were made of the area, which are probably, so the only times there would have been sketches made would have been potentially with David Thompson. I'm trying to remember if there were any.
I don't recall any.
And then De Smet. And then the next one would have been the border survey in the 1860s. So this was kind of the one chance in this time period to document what was happening here.
Yeah.
For the Europeans.
Well, very interesting. I'll ask further questions later on. Okay. I have more to ask about the ruins and stuff, but continue with your tale. There he was overwintering.
Yeah. So the following spring, with his route east still blocked with snow, he was trying to get back to St. Mary's, but it had been a hard winter. De Smet started looking for a new site for the Kalispell Mission. He felt that the Albany Falls site was too close to the influence of white pioneers, and he wanted something more remote. A site downriver that he called the Bay of the Kalispells had lush prairies, cedar and pine forests, and a small waterfall. He perceived this area very romantically, and he imagined fields of crops and a future sawmill powered by the waterfall. He also found a small cave in the hillside, which reminded him of a cavern in Manresa, Spain, where a young Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit order, once spent a year. And this was the sign he was looking for, that this was the place to relocate the St. Michael's Mission. And this is in the area near Usk, Washington today, where the Kalispell Reservation is.
And that is that cave you can actually go to.
It's amazing.
That still exists.
Yeah, the Manresa Grotto. Yeah, it's incredible.
That was on last time I was in Usk. That was on my list, but I didn't make it.
Okay, so we've got a field trip.
Yeah, that looks really cool, and you can actually go see this this place. So he's been in the Northwest for now 5 years or so.
Yeah,
give or take. Okay, how long does a mission take? Does he spend the rest of his life here, or what's next for Father Pierre Jean De Smet?
Well, great question. His team of missionaries expanded. He assigned Father DeVois to continue his work with the Kalispell tribe, whose reports indicated success in establishing St. Michael's Mission in Usk. They built a smaller altar inside the cave and held masses there. According to Carriker, De Smet loved to start missions, but he seldom remained in them for long. He sought glamour by planning, establishing, and publicizing the Indian missions. That is him just in a nutshell, really.
The serial entrepreneur.
Yes, mm-hmm. And he's on to the mm-hmm. next thing. Mm-hmm. So internal bickering plagued the missionaries, and as time passed, they began to fear the conversion of the tribes would never be complete. So the bad influence of pioneer vices were seeping in, and they noted that when a tribe left the mission to hunt and return to the forest or plains, they returned to their pagan lifestyles. Mm. Mm. So only one tribe was so isolated by outside influence that they met the criteria for a potential complete conversion. And you'll never believe who it was.
Mm.
The Blackfeet.
Huh. Well, that's interesting.
The Blackfeet dominated nearly all of the less fierce tribes for hundreds of miles around. The Jesuits felt true conversion of the interior tribes would never stick unless the Blackfeet accepted Christianity. Many traders, brokers, and other powerful settlers tried to discourage De Smet, warning him he'd likely be killed for his efforts. But he proudly pursued the ultimate challenge. And the risk was worth it. The Blackfeet were receptive to his intercession with the all-powerful being they called the Master of Life. What he didn't foresee, though, was that to the Flatheads, his meeting with the Blackfeet amounted to a profound betrayal. The, quote, moral equivalent of an arms merchant supplying both sides in a war. By embracing Catholicism, the other tribes believed they could finally overcome the Blackfeet's domination of the region. Now, did they still have a reason to worship the Christian God?
Mm.
This is fascinating.
Really fascinating.
Yeah. Huh.
So as De Smet's attention continued to be pulled to new projects, he started to lose control of the key missions. It didn't help that Protestant-Catholic missionary competition bred hostility, confusion, and mistrust. Missionaries put more demands on the tribes, and more natives succumbed to disease. Within a decade, the Central St. Mary's Mission and the Blackfeet Mission closed. Forced land cessions, war, removal of reservations, and decades of despair followed. Hmm. So anti-Catholic sentiment began to grip America as well. In 1846, De Smet was fired as leader of another of the key missions and began to pivot away from his dream of a network of missions. He dedicated the rest of his life to being an advocate for peace. I feel like he kind of learned his lesson on, you know, he was always so focused on the goal, and he had like that moment of clarity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some call like a come to Jesus. Sorry, yeah. I can help myself. He lent his charismatic presence as a trusted military and government and missionary in treaty negotiations with reluctant or hostile Indian nations. His most notable time was during the Fort Laramie Treaty negotiations of 1868 with Sitting Bull. He saw reservations as a refuge for Indians to explore their newfound Catholic faith without the corrupting traditions. Networking with the tribes and other missionaries and going back to St. Louis or Europe. Hmm. Excuse me, sorry. Scratch that. So, their newfound Catholic faith without the corrupting influence of white settlers. He couldn't imagine how different the government's intentions could be.
Yeah. Hmm. Interesting. But he's, so, if, yeah, he's, so 1846, he's, well, he's, he was born in 1801. Mm-hmm. So, he's not an old nope. man, but he seems to.
He's 45.
Becoming
he's
sort of an elder.
Life.
An old, yes.
Yeah.
An elder statesman of sorts. Or he's, mm-hmm. he's a respected figure and a.
Right.
Yeah.
And well, he's having to kind of rethink his whole purpose mm-hmm. for being in America.
Yeah. And in the relationships that he built too, how mm-hmm. important those would be. It's yeah. beautiful that he was wanting to represent and create peace. And
I did see something where he was saying that he said he wanted 20 years of time with the Inland Northwest tribes before pioneers got to them. He was like, I want 20 years to fully convert yeah. the tribal people before they're introduced to all of the chaos that the settlers would bring. Mm-hmm. And so he was really just working in a completely different time frame than the American government was. You know, westward expansion was a big priority, and he couldn't stop all of the other people who were heading into the area he was trying to work on.
Let's see. So we are, so that's almost the end of the story, I guess. He's, he does meet, but he meets with, so Sitting Bull in 1868.
Now he's in his 60s. And his job was to convince Sitting Bull to sign the treaty with the U.S. government, which he felt he was doing the best thing he could for the tribes. You know, that's not really how that turned out. During the 19th century, Native American religion was forced underground. A core of their traditional beliefs and practices continued and reemerged in the late 20th century under a new message of cultural strength and survival. In a belated gesture of tolerance and apology, the United States in 1978 passed the American Religious Freedom Act, designed to protect the traditional beliefs, religious sites, and practices of all Native Americans. And over the last 30 years, you do see the reemergence of some Native beliefs within Christian ritual and vice versa. For some tribes, the Catholic Mass is still celebrated, but it can incorporate sacred, so plants that are sacred to the tribes, as well as traditional drum and pipe music.
Well, I think we, I guess we come to the question of what is the, what finally is the legacy of Pierre Jean de Smet or Peter Jean de Smet? Well, by the way, how did that mix up happen? Why, so, why did he get a different name?
Peter would have been his Belgian name. It has the Dutch spelling, and then the Jesuit faith, I believe, was, well, no, Ignatius Loyola would have been Spanish, but there was a big chapter of the order that was French, so I think he would have adopted a French version of his name at some point while he was in training. I'm not positive.
Do we know what he was born as? Do we know what he was like going around calling himself as?
So that is kind of curious, because in some parts of the Catholic faith, you would adopt a saint's name. And so it is kind of strange to me that, to, you know, from what I read, at least, he did not. He always went by Pierre Jean or John, or, and maybe it was just that, you know, his Peter and John were both saints' names. So that was fine.
And Pierre Jean is a very suave name.
That's true. It added to his charisma. Perhaps.
It sells people the most. So he reportedly traveled over 180,000 miles in his mission work and fundraising missions.
That is, what, three times what we think David Thompson traveled?
Incredible, right?
Wow.
I don't know.
And that's the thing. Like, we all know about Lewis and Clark, and we all, like, in, if you live in Idaho and you've gone through fourth grade here, you all know about David Thompson. But you don't, this was actually my first introduction of Smet.
And it's, we couldn't include it all, but it is very interesting to read his anecdotes about the travel itself. Because he's someone who came to America because he had this unquenchable sense of adventure. But he gets here and he's, you know, wearing these long black wool robes and he's having to, like, ford rivers and, you know, travel into all these dangerous places. And he kind of, there's a point where he's kind of just seems over it. He's like, I hated this part of the journey. It was terrible. But he still has that drive to get to the place he's going.
Very mission focused.
And he never, I mean, he's going, he's going on these treacherous journeys and never falls and breaks his leg or anything like that, as far as we know. I mean, I'm sure he had scrapes and bumps and stuff. But
we could probably do a sequel episode on
just his injuries. He had a lot of kind of illnesses.
Ah.
I didn't read anything about any bad accidents where he broke bones or things, but he had some really bad lung infections. He got sick fairly easily, it seemed. So, but somehow he always came through. He was very skeptical of American medicine. Which he felt was very old-fashioned. And there was one point where he's having leeches applied to him, and he's just like, take me to Europe. I can't deal with these American doctors. They don't know what they're doing. Oh, so he did actually go back to Europe at least once just to get medical attention.
Wow. So that's quite a journey.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, his writings are crucial to the documentation of this area. So otherwise there was little known about this. We talked about that, how there was, you know, David Thompson and then Lewis and Clark, some fur trappers, but he never stayed in one place very long, but he had earnest intentions, although sometimes misplaced. He is still remembered fondly by many tribal members.
I know there's a few, you know, monuments, and we mentioned already the grotto, and that's, of course, kind of a natural formation, but there's...
And is that open to the public?
It is.
I think so.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go there next time. Eastern Washington.
You could feel the presence of... But my music's going to come back on. I bet that would be an incredible experience. I'll have to go.
Yeah, it seems pretty cool. There's a cross somewhere, right? Isn't there a cross that he erected, or maybe not? Maybe I'm mistaken about that.
In this incredible book, Sacred Encounters, and I just want to give a shout out to it. It's the most beautiful book. It's a great coffee table book as well. And forgive me, I want to find the author of that. There's so many artifacts from De Smet, archival materials and objects that are in some of the museums in the region, particularly over in Montana. And it just really inspired me to actually kind of go on a sojourn and rediscover his travels and see his objects and everything. So this was a project done by Washington State University, this book, Sacred Encounters, and it was written by Jacqueline Peterson with Laura Pierce. And that's where we really were able to get a lot of the information, the accounts from the native tribes that were there.
Yeah.
Their stories. But it's a picture book as well. So it's something that I actually had my 11-year-old sit down with me and take in.
Cool.
It's just beautiful.
Okay.
And if you do, you were kind of asking, like, what is still around?
Yeah.
If you do want to see a mission building that still exists, the Cataldo Mission down on off of Highway 90, between Coeur d'Alene and Kellogg, is still there. It is one of it is the oldest still existing building built in Idaho. And they do tours. You can go down and visit that and get a sense of what a mission would actually have been like.
That's incredible.
Yeah, that's very cool. And not too far from here.
No.
We could do that.
A couple hours.
Yeah. But as far as his kind of cultural legacy that persists, it's mostly in what he wrote and kind of his documentation of the area. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, it seems like he was kind of... You know, what changes he had wrought were kind of either undone or overwritten by the changes that would come later on.
Yeah. And we did focus for this show on the missionary work he did here in kind of North Idaho, Western Montana. Mm-hmm. Much of his career, though, was spent in more of that kind of advocacy negotiations role as the U.S. government started expanding into the West and trying to make treaties with the tribes throughout the Western United States.
Yeah.
I think you'd also see his work through the influence of Catholicism within the native tribes as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
which was like the why.
Yeah.
came here, right?
There is still a Catholic church at the Kalispell Reservation in Washington.
Interesting.
Okay. I don't know.
This is definitely a subject that I'm personally going to be spending more time on. It's so fascinating.
It is, right? Yeah, it's very interesting. And he was a missionary, and he was focused really on, his focus was on the tribes.
Yeah.
And so
spreading the word, but that led to so much more.
Yeah. I mean, my question is of Catholics, do the currently exist, like there's a Catholic church in town, St. Joseph's over there on Lincoln Street. Is there any, does the existing Catholic community that's here now trace any kind of roots, to those days, or is it all?
Probably not.
Right.
Because we're seeing, these missions were kind of shutting down around from like the mid 1840s until maybe a decade later. And then the first rounds of permanent settlers to this area specifically were coming in like at the earliest, the 1860s.
Yeah.
And then really picking up in the 1880s. So there would have been a gap there. So it seems unlikely, other than by maybe the native tribes saying like, hey, the Black Ribs came to us and shared this faith with us. But there wouldn't have been a direct influence from the Jesuits to the settlers up here.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, anything else in conclusion about this man?
Just that there's so many more questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot more to read.
An interesting
learn.
Life. Yeah. What are we doing next time, folks? What's our next episode?
So we talked about discussing what we know as the Mullen Road, but I learned reading about DeSmet that it was technically called the Military Road. But we'll learn a little bit about that and about some of the forts that were developed in this region.
Okay. That's cool. This is going to be a fun one. Real quick, what's coming up at the museum, at the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum? You guys have any events coming up this?
Yeah, of course. We have on the first Saturday of the month, July 5th, we have Free First Saturday. Admission is free from 10 until 2. We will also have hands-on history activities for kids that day. We will be in the 4th of July parade. So if you want to walk with the museum, just let us know. And then we're really excited on July 20th, on a Sunday afternoon, we are going to be having a pioneer picnic. This is a tradition that goes back to the 1920s, and it's been done kind of on and off over the years, but it's just a way to bring the community together and enjoy some time outside in Lakeview Park. We're going to have carnival games. We're going to have ice cream churning, and there will be some food options. So bring a picnic blanket and join us in the park. It'll be a lot of fun. It's also our membership drive for the summer. So if you sign up to become a new member of the Historical Society, you will get a bunch of free tickets that you can use to play games. And it should be a good time.
So fun.
Cool. That's Sunday, July 20th is the Pioneer Picnic. And July 5th is Free First Saturday. Fun. Yeah. We've come to the end of our program. Thanks for listening to the Community Character Hour here on 88.5 KRFY. This is Panhandle Community Radio. I'm Jack Peterson. Heather Upton, Hannah Combs, thanks for coming in for another Community Character Hour. We'll see you next month.
See you next time.
See you then.
We're here on the second and fourth, Monday of every month. So tune in for us next time. Thanks for listening.